Thank you so much. Rick, I've known Rick for 20 years, maybe more at this point. Rick has always been one of the most amazing, progressive, and forward-thinking people I've ever known. And so when I think about what he's talked about today, you know, there's a couple of questions that come up to mind for me. One of those questions, Rick, is ever since I've known you, you have been a bit of an iconoclast, which is to say, you came into corrections a long time ago and you did everything differently than anybody's ever done it. And I think it's important to understand, A, you survived that because you have a philosophy of treating inmates with respect. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the theory of expect good behavior, get good behavior, and kind of how that ties into your philosophical approach of the comments you made here today, because it goes to the element, the culture in the Cheshire County Jail, which in many ways is absolutely unique, almost in the country, in terms of violence, in terms of assaults, in terms of lawsuits. And it's your philosophy that carries through and makes that happen. So can you talk a little bit about this concept of treating inmates with respect and the differences that you engage in when you train your correctional officers?
Thank you very much. It's a great question. I started my correctional career as an entry-level officer in 1987. We didn't have computers or Google in 1987. The jail where I worked did not have a training officer. When I did my job, I saw a lot of things that didn't look right and they didn't feel right, and I wasn't sure that I'd be able to stay in the business. My father always told me, don't do what's popular, do what's right. And not having any training, if it didn't look right or feel right, I wouldn't engage in it. But now I felt like the exception in this environment and I didn't think I could stay. And then they promoted me to be the director of training. And without Google, I had to buy books and I had to read about corrections. And what I was reading was, it doesn't look right and it doesn't feel right because it's not. And so I had to start to convince other people who had been in corrections for 17 years when I was entry level, why it was a better idea to do it the way I was proposing to do it. And that was a significant challenge. I had a rough upbringing, and this is getting to the respect part of the question, a rough upbringing, and by God's grace, do I end up on this side of the wire rather than the other? I will say that most of my teachers in high school said that I would probably spend my entire adult life incarcerated. They were right about that, but I just don't think they got... I don't think they had this side of the fence in mind. But I always knew growing up on the street that respect was a very big thing. And I was a person who knew that when I was talking to an incorrigible, dangerous offender, he didn't care about my badge. He didn't care about my position at all. You know who does? Law-abiding people do. A badge and a uniform and your positional authority has no value on the block. But respect does. And even as the superintendent today, when I talk to offenders in crisis, it's not superintendent talking to an offender. It's one gentleman talking to another gentleman. Because when we expect good behavior, we get good behavior. When we advance respect, we get respect. And that is a challenge that Jack highlighted that I still live every single day. I'm still trying to convince people that this is the way that we have to manage our institution.
Rick, a question from the audience. Could you speak briefly on your use of solitary confinement in corrections? As we've read in the paper across the country, many people are held in solitary confinement for profoundly long periods of time with seemingly little benefit but great damage. Can you talk about your use of solitary confinement?
Would be glad to. It's a great question. It's a very serious topic. We've had people from around the country come and look into how we utilize segregation. Segregation in jail is primarily two reasons that you would do it, administratively or punitive. Punitive involves due process, a person violating the rules that they knew to be wrong, found guilty by an objective board, and sanctioned to a period of time in segregation. Administrative segregation is looser. It only requires the perception that the correctional authority views the individual as a threat to themselves, the institution, or other people. Now, the problem with that standard in American corrections is that a lot of agencies exercise that standard to put dangerous and incorrigible people into isolation and leave them there, which is horrible. They begin to deteriorate. What we've learned is that having a very brief encounter with segregation is much more effective. And again, this goes back to Sir Robert Peel, John Howard, and all of our founders who said, knowing what the rules are, having an objective view of whether or not you violated them, having swift justice, and a brief sanction is the most effective way to manage behavior. That's what we've done in our particular situation. Nobody can serve more than 15 days of segregation in our institution when the ACA says indefinite period of time. In order to stay in segregation longer than that with us, a person would have to re-offend. In other words, they would have to re-exhibit continually violent behavior. And we do have people with violent behavior. The point is, the right people should be segregated for the right amount of time. To segregate people long-term is harmful for their personal health and wellness and psychological well-being. It really is an abused standard in our profession and ought to be looked at more closely.
We have a number of questions about what you're doing and what your role is working with the legislature and government to kind of increase drug management policies and programs.
I have testified many, many times before Senate subcommittees and House subcommittee hearings on, for an example, the adult use of marijuana. For all the reasons that was cited here this morning, I've talked to some subcommittees about segregation. I've talked to some subcommittees about the use of restraints. Another thing that we have been, in my view, I don't know what the word is to use. I'll just put it right out there. A lot of prisons and jails use restraints for women who are pregnant or in labor. They will restrain a woman in labor to the hospital bed. I will not authorize that. I will not authorize a pregnant woman to be shackled under any circumstance, never shackled or restrained during labor. And there was some legislative hearings on the use of restraints at the prison years ago. So anything that I think we can impact in a positive way, I will be there to talk to subcommittees, although I don't know how effective my testimony has been because New Hampshire is still where it is and a lot of issues.
I will say that with respect to those programs, that Cheshire County was the first county court system in the state to initiate an alternative sentencing program for those folks who wanted treatment rather than incarceration. And it was the first county in the state that created the state's first mental health court, that but for their mental illness, they might not have committed crimes. So Rick's participation in those discussions by identifying people who would be better off getting treatment rather than incarceration has been pretty critical. Rick, moving on to other questions, because there are a lot of them. Privatization of prison systems has been around for a long time. It has gone through phases where it's been resoundingly rejected, and there seems to be a bit of a resurgence in privatizing the criminal justice system. Can you comment on that?
Privatization is a very bad thing. It's a very bad thing for the following reason. You know, our government operates jails. Originally, it operated the post office because these were cost centers. These were things that our community needed, but was not the kind of business that should turn a profit or ought to turn a profit. But there's a cost associated with operations. And so I can tell you, being Dutch, that I do things as cheaply as possible. My wife is here, she will attest to that. And so here's the challenge that I put out to anybody who says privatization is okay or that it works. I have to determine what it takes to run a safe Department of Corrections for all of the inmates and the staff that are in that building, and my response to critical incidents, health issues, mental health issues, food, and so on, and submit that to the county commissioners, one of which is Jack, who then has to approve those funds. And one of the things that commissioners do is make sure that we're not asking for more money than we need to provide the minimal services that we have. Now, notice in this entire budget requisition or approval process, there is no line item for profit. And what a private agency says is they will come to a jurisdiction and say, let me run your jail. You just give me a check every month and I'll take care of your jail. Well, I know what it costs to operate a jail. I know what it costs to provide adequate medical care and do all of these other specific things. And so in order for privatization to do it cheaper than I can, they've got to make money. Their money has to be a motivator. And in order to do it more cheaply than this Dutchman, what are you going to cut? You're going to cut services. You're going to cut food, medical care, and the good people that I told you I'm having a hard time finding, they will get people of even lesser caliber. And that's what they're doing in a lot of places across the country. It's not okay. The conditions of confinement are bad. And the final point that I'll make is, if that private agency does something wrong and litigation results, the county cannot give away their liability. They're still liable for what happens because they're responsible for what happens. And so privatization is not a good thing. Profit should not be a motivator. If you look at the problems in our country with big pharma, prisons, all the other things that we have going on, the drug war, you will find that the one astronomical monster that moves that whole thing is profit motive.
Final question. There are a ton of questions. We're not going to be able to get to them. But Rick, many people say that what you do in Cheshire County and how you run the jail simply can't be done in other correctional facilities. So the question is, why is that? And do you think that's true? Do you think that you're the only one that can kind of make corrections different than anybody else?
No. It can happen anywhere. And I'll give you some disclosure right now that I oftentimes don't do. But it's the difference between being a professional or a non-professional. It's the difference between being that technical person I told you about or the person who has academics behind what they do. And the disclosure is this. Oftentimes when things come down the pike and I'm reading research and papers that say to me, this is what we ought to do, I think, oh, come on, that's in here. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my confirmation bias. That, ladies and gentlemen, is my default picture. That is my individual thinking over institutional thinking. And what I learned to do as a young man in this business was challenge my confirmation bias, read research, look at the facts, and I still might not be sold on it, but you know what? The evidence is in because facts matter and science matters. So now I'm going to go out to my personnel and say, this is the vision. This is what we have to do. And you know what? Their reaction is the same as my reaction. Are you kidding me? I don't want to do that. And it's like, well, you got to do that. You're going to do that or you're not going to work here. And that's been a significant challenge all these years to make sure that the vision that we have is in the corner office and flows all the way down and has the approval and the right philosophy, ideology, and strategic planning that the commissioners want on behalf of the constituency. That's how it has to work. The person who heads the agency has to believe it, and if they don't believe it, they have to challenge their confirmation bias and then work hard to change everybody else's. And at the end of the day, we'll know we're right. Thank you.
Thank you again, Rick, for sharing your time and expertise with us. Can we have another round of applause, please?
Thank you.
Our program next Sunday will feature Peterborough author and artist Lita Judge speaking about her new book, Mary's Monster, Love, Madness, and How Mary Shelley Created Frankenstein.